This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest grew up loving math and numbers, and she turned that love of math into a career, first in the academic world and then in business as a number cruncher for a hedge fund. She says that experience opened her eyes to the way math is misused and abused in our society.
In her new book, she says we need to pay more attention to the way mathematical algorithms are used to determine who gets jobs and keeps jobs, who goes to jail and who doesn't, who gets loans and who gets targeted by predatory lenders. And she says when you add it all up, these algorithms end up stacking the deck against poor people and people of color.
Kathy O'Neill joins us now. She's a data scientist and author of the blog Math Babe. Her new book is Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, leading up to your book, you've got this lifelong love of math. You went from using your math skills for a hedge fund to teaching financial math to Occupy Wall Street protesters. What led you to this huge change?
Well, I would frame it more like I joined Occupy, and part of joining Occupy is sharing knowledge. I guess the short version is I was extremely disillusioned by working in finance. I had this naive, idealistic concept leaving academics in 2007 that I could bring sort of the beauty and honesty and clarity of mathematics to the real world in finance. But when I got there, I realized that there were like a bunch of mathematical lies, and there's a really big mathematical lie in the heart of the financial crisis, namely the AAA ratings of mortgage-backed securities. Those were, you know, supposed to be mathematical risk ratings. They were supposed to be performed by, you know, mathematicians, math PhDs in the back room of the credit rating agencies, sort of diligently going over the data that they had and making sure that things were very low risk. And that was a lie. In fact, they knew that the mortgage-backed securities were extremely toxic, and they were selling those ratings, but they were calling it mathematical, and it was kind of a weaponized form of mathematics that I was really ashamed of.
And so you went out in search of other forms on your Math Babe blog and now in the book, Weapons of Math Destruction, and a lot of what you're talking about in the book is the way we as a society in so many different walks of life use algorithms to make important decisions. Before we get into specific examples, give us a 101. What is an algorithm? How do they function in our lives?
Great question. An algorithm is simply a process, usually a decision-making process. Often in the examples I give in the book, they're scoring processes. But the way you build an algorithm is that you provide a bunch of historical data where you can look for patterns. And then some kind of definition of success, so you're looking for patterns for that definition of success. So you might be looking for the perfect job candidate to hire, and then you give the historical data you would give is like the history of all the people that ever applied to your company, and the definition of success, which you would be in charge of defining, would be something like that person stays at the company for 5 years and is promoted twice. And then what the algorithm would do when you train it on that historical data set is it would look for patterns in historical data that would indicate somebody who is going to be successful with that definition.
And somebody might look at that, and you're right, many people have looked at that idea of this mathematical way to evaluate a job candidate or a lot of other things that we'll get into and say, well, that's great. Because, you know, the old sloppy way you had people, they had biases, they might have discriminated. Now we're going to math this out and have this perfectly objective way of evaluating candidates. And that's where we run into trouble, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, like, just in the example I just gave, I mean, there's no reason to think that algorithm trained on historical data would be in any way objective, right? All it would do, and all algorithms do, is pattern match. So it would just simply find the patterns of your company's past practices, and it would predict that those patterns will be repeated. So if your company had a history of being, you know, of discriminating against women for hiring and engineering jobs, for example, or if your company, once they hired women, didn't let them succeed by the definition of success that you chose, then that algorithm would pattern match and would filter out women as potentially unsuccessful. So there's this the number one thing I wish to do with my book is to slam home the fact that algorithms are not inherently objective. They are biased. The data they're given is often biased itself, but also they have embedded values of the person building the model, because one of the things you do, again, is you define success. And success is, you know, a value judgment.
I think in the earlier days of programming, I remember the phrase, and it kept coming back to me as I looked at your book, garbage in, garbage out, meaning flaws that went into your programming would lead to flaws in your output. It sounds like we're just recreating that, but now on a level that's really affecting a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So sometimes when you say garbage in, garbage out, you actually mean, like, if you have bad data or dirty data or inaccurate data, then you have inaccurate output. And that's, of course, true. But what we also see is what you just mentioned, that if you have biased data, which is to say you have, you know, hiring practices in our example that were already flawed, then what you're going to do is train the algorithm to repeat the past. You're just propagating forward in time the historical patterns, which is to say, if we had a perfect and fair process by which to hire people, we would want to automate that. We would, because it would save time and money. But until we have something that's perfect, automating it is the same thing as just propagating those patterns.
Talking to Kathy O'Neill, her new book is called Weapons of Math Destruction. That's Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, I want to get into some more examples now. Crime and Punishment is a place, and this has been in the news some over the last few months, of ways algorithms get used. One that got a lot of attention was in sentencing. How do we evaluate somebody, their likelihood to commit a new crime, how long they should be put in jail? How are algorithms going into that and recreating, as you say, the biases that were already there?
Right. So the most important thing you have to understand is that every criminal defendant is being given a score, a recidivism score, the likelihood of them returning to prison after they leave after 2 years. And I should say that 97% of prisoners eventually leave prison, so this is an important question. But what's critical to understand is that if people are assigned a higher risk score, then they, generally speaking, get put in prison for longer. So there's a real consequence to getting these high risk scores. So we have to be very careful that these risk scores are being built fairly. And that's what my concern is that the kind of data that goes into those scores is highly biased against poor people and against people of color. So there's every reason to think that people are assigned these high-risk scores by dint of their demographics rather than their actual behavior.
And another, staying with Crime and Punishment for a moment, another algorithm that gets used is, hey, where should we put police? Where should we prioritize law enforcement to prevent crimes? Which, again, sounds like a good thing. The consequence, you say, though, is that police end up being in areas, again, with poor people, often with people of color. And those people then, for a minor crime, a public intoxication or something like that, are more subject to a police encounter than someone, say, on a university campus would be with the same behavior. And that ends up haunting them in a lot of other algorithms down the road.
Exactly right. And it's for the reasons I already laid out for the hiring algorithm. All these algorithms really do is pattern match. So if we have a pattern of police finding crimes, nuisance crimes, crimes of poverty or mental health problems or addiction, if they have a pattern of doing that in certain neighborhoods, which they do because of the broken windows policies we have all over the country, then the algorithms, which are supposed to be scientific, basically just give an excuse for police to go back to those same neighborhoods and continue to over-police them. One of the thought experiments I like to share in this realm is the idea that after the financial crisis, we could have sent all the police down to Wall Street to arrest the bankers and to harass their friends, which would be sort of the equivalent of the gang members that we talk about when we talk about like poor black neighborhoods. And they would have found a lot of street drugs on those guys. And then the predictive policing algorithm with that kind of data would have said, oh, police, you should go back to Wall Street because that's where the criminals are. But since we never did that, we're simply repeating the past practices of the police.
And that reminds me, and when you talk about another realm of algorithms that was popular, is popular, teacher evaluation, trying to come up with objective ways to rate teachers, led to some teachers being fired, in effect, based in part on their algorithm evaluations. One problem, among the problems you see with that, is that there's no checkup, there's no feedback, there's no looking back and saying, okay, are we getting better teachers because of this? Are we firing the right people, keeping the right people? That's a common problem with these this use of algorithms.
That's right. One of the fundamental characteristics of a really successful algorithm is that it gets better over time. And the way it gets better over time is that it's compared to some kind of ground truth. So, for example, if Amazon shows me a product that it thinks that Amazon thinks that I might be interested in, but I never click on it, nor does anybody else who has a similar shopping history to mine, then Amazon eventually, their algorithm learns not to show that. It's just not a winner. So it updates its algorithm. The problem, one of the problems with the teaching algorithm is that it was its own reality. There was no ground truth against which these scores were compared. And so there was no way to know what the model was doing well or to improve it. And in particular, and it didn't get improved, and it was actually not an accurate model.
I want to track a little bit of a lifespan of a low-income person, maybe person of color, and how they encounter algorithms. You're low-income, you're from a low-income neighborhood, which might lead it to be harder for you to get a job. You have more police encounters based on algorithms, which makes it harder to get a job. These things end up going on your credit score because you can't get a job. That makes it harder to get a job in the future. These things all keep reinforcing each other. Harder to get a mortgage makes you more the target, you say in the book, of predatory lenders. It snowballs. It never ends, does it?
That's right. And I should mention that a lot of the minimum wage jobs have, in addition to what you just mentioned, they have these excruciating personality tests that you have to take that filter out 85% of the people who apply. And then once you have a job, a lot of the minimum wage job workers are subject to these crazy scheduling algorithms that prevent them from having regular schedules and from getting a second job or going to school at night. So it's a real problem, and it's a kind of a secret, invisible problem, because for the most part, the technologists like myself, we don't see the suffering when we develop these models. We see it as sorting the winners or the losers, but we're mostly the winners. And that's one of the reasons I decided to write the book, because I just thought it's like a financial crisis, except that nobody will notice. And so I wanted to make sure people are aware of these issues.
So our society loves big data. It loves objective, or what appear to be objective, measures. It seems like corporate decision makers, government policy makers all over the place are wanting to do more and more of this. How do you see us either reversing that trend or at least continuing it with algorithms that actually work?
Well, I agree. It's going to be tough because a lot of these algorithms make just a ton of money for the companies in question. Those scheduling algorithms I mentioned, one of the constraints that you can put into the algorithm is to keep people from having enough hours per week to qualify for benefits. And that really does, it does actually benefit the company who uses it. So to some extent, I'm asking for increased regulation, and in particular, modified laws from the anti-discrimination laws that were built in the 70s, that were written in the 70s, but haven't really incorporated the new kinds of methods that the big data companies can employ. Other examples, I think maybe the data companies will start paying more attention to, because to some extent, I want to be fair, I don't think that all the people who are working within the industry of big data are really aware of all these problems. So I'm hoping for some people to do the right thing.
We'll leave it there, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Kathy O'Neill, data scientist and author of the new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy.